Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more.
Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our seventh look at the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman. Before we get into it, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Podcast, or Deathcast Official. You can find me on most social media platforms under one of those names. If you'd like to help the show out, there's a couple of ways that you can do that. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. Also, subscribe to the show. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast to make a one-time donation. Lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCast Patreon, where for as little as $2.99 a month, you can become a Patreon member and get access to early access shows as well as exclusive content such as the Columbine case as well as the Vince McMahon series. As always, I have to give a shout out to my very first Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. Thank you guys for your support of this show. It is greatly appreciated. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back, relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last week, detectives from Los Angeles had interviewed individuals in Chicago from the hotel that Simpson had stayed at, as well as taken some evidence, most specifically two of the glasses that Simpson said he had cut his hand on in the bathroom after learning of his wife's murder. They had also gotten a lot of information concerning the gloves that were found at both crime scenes as well as the pair of shoes believed to have been worn by the killer, which were a pair of Bruno Maglis that were very specific and that Simpson was known to have owned. Moving on into September of 1994, the detectives continue with their investigation, interviewing individuals known to Nicole Brown Simpson. On September 6th, they interviewed a woman by the name of Deanne Persily Laban, who informs officers that she and Nicole had been close friends up until the summer of 1993, when Simpson unexpectedly forced his wife to stop being friends with her. Persily Laban also recounts a story of she and Nicole walking on the beach at Monarch Bay, wherein Nicole is said to have told her, quote, "Everywhere I go, he shows up. I really think he's going to kill me." She also states that at Nicole's funeral, Judith Brown, Nicole's mother, walked up to Simpson and asked him whether or not he had killed her daughter, to which Simpson replied, "I loved her. I loved her." Judith Brown would later confirm that this quasi-confrontation did in fact take place, and that she had simply walked away from Simpson after this encounter. The next day, we have more worms coming out of the woodwork in the form of Kris Jenner and her then-husband Bruce Jenner, who's an Olympic gold medalist. Kris Jenner is the ex-husband of Robert Kardashian. According to Kris Jenner, 3 days after the murder, Simpson had called her, which she found odd, as Kris was really more friends with Nicole than she had been with Simpson. And during the course of this phone conversation, Kris Jenner starts to grill OJ about the bloody glove that was found on his property. And Kris states that Simpson then sarcastically replied, quote, "I wish they would have put that in your backyard." Kris states that she met Nicole for the first time when she married Robert Kardashian in 1978, while Simpson was still married to his first wife, and that Nicole often would complain about the fact that OJ was unfaithful to her. At one point, informing Kris, quote unquote, "I can't leave him, he'll kill me." Jenner also states that after the divorce, she and Nicole remained close friends, and that Nicole had confided to her one day while they were out jogging that she believed Simpson was going to eventually kill her, asking Jenner to help her make a tape recording wherein Nicole would discuss her concerns with her ex-husband, so that she could place this in a safe deposit box in the event that something happened to her. Unfortunately, Nicole never had the opportunity to make this tape. If she had, things at the trial may have gone differently for O.J. Simpson. Detectives also spoke with individuals who had responded to the Simpson home on January 1st, 1989, that's the infamous domestic battery call wherein Nicole was hiding in the bushes and covered in bruises from head to toe. And from these individuals, they learned that Nicole had informed them that her husband on that night was coked up and had assaulted her while Nicole lay in bed. They also learn that Simpson wrote two letters to his wife, one in which he apologized, and another where it seems as though he was victim-blaming, basically telling his wife that because you called the police on me, if this happens again, I'll be facing a mandatory jail term. This is a fairly common tactic of abusers when law enforcement becomes involved or family members learn about it, as opposed to facing up to their actions and accepting responsibility for them. They turn it around and make the victim the offending party in this, i.e., look what I have to go through now because of you. It is another tool of manipulation that is applied quite often and successfully, unfortunately. They are also informed that after entering his no contest plea, Simpson appeared openly contemptuous of both the charges, the judge, and law enforcement officials in court. So the picture that is emerging more and more of O.J. Simpson is of an individual with a very large ego who feels as though he is above the law and whose wife is fearful of her life because of the actions of her husband. Now, unfortunately, we don't know every single nuance of their relationship, and by that I mean we don't know much of the things that Simpson would say when these abusive episodes would take place within the home. And the main reason for that is not a lot of the domestic violence that took place within the Simpson household was documented. Had Nicole been able to make the videotape that she had wanted to with Kris Jenner, she more likely than not would have shed a lot of light on what was actually taking place that has basically been left to speculation in the decades since Nicole's murder. Not long after speaking with these officials, the detectives investigating the Nicole Brown Simpson murder then talk with an individual by the name of Spencer Marks, who is one of the officers who responded to Nicole Brown Simpson's home at Greta Green Way on October 25th, 1993. If you'll recall, this is the infamous 911 call that Nicole had made, wherein OJ can be heard screaming in the background, making accusations that his wife was hanging out with prostitutes and doing cocaine and performing oral sex in front of their children. Marks stated that upon his arrival at 10:05 p.m., he noticed Simpson's white Ford Bronco parked illegally in the middle of the street with the lights on and the engine off. They were met by Nicole at the front door, who informed them that Simpson was in the back of the house and that she wanted him removed from the property. Officer Marks stated that they saw that the French doors in the back of the home had been destroyed and that Simpson had admitted it to causing the damage after Nicole refused him entry into the home. Officer Marks further stated that Cato Kalin was in fact present on this night, although he was attempting to remain neutral in the dispute between them. Later, Officer Marks would send the officers investigating the murder further information concerning the night of October 25th, 1993. Quote, both OJ and Nicole dated other people. Nicole saw evidence of OJ's ex-girlfriend and asked him to remove all pictures, etc., of his time spent with the other woman. Earlier in the day, when he had been invited, he saw a picture of Nicole with her ex-boyfriend and asked her to reciprocate by removing this and any other pictures, etc., of her relationship. According to OJ, Nicole refused to remove those pictures, and that created the tension and anger later that same night. OJ was angry and upset and was talking with us loudly at first until we calmed him down and we spent approximately 1 hour talking to him. Nicole refused to press charges for trespass, etc., and wanted to make sure that OJ was going to pay for the damage. OJ insisted he would pay for the repairs, and we convinced him to leave. After we left, we spent some time with Nicole, and during that time, she voiced her concerns about his temper. Lastly, Nicole stated that although they had attempted to get back together several times since their divorce, she was not sure it would work due to his violent acts and their differences. Officers Lang and Van Adder are also contacted by Officer Mark's supervisor, who informs them that he has actually tape-recorded an interview with Nicole Brown Simpson from that period of time. During this recorded interview, Nicole states, quote, when OJ gets this crazed, I get scared. He gets a very animalistic look in him. His eyes are black. I mean cold, like an animal. Now, right after gathering all of this information, the police learn that the defense team is now going to start trying to really poke holes in all of the things that took place on the night of Nicole's murder and into the next morning. On September 21st, there is a challenge made to the original search warrant that's Philip Van Adder had obtained for O.J. Simpson's North Rockingham estate. And basically, what the defense is trying to do is state that all of the things that Van Adder had written in the request for the search warrant and on the search warrant itself were inaccurate. And they based this on the fact that Van Adder had written that Simpson's trip to Chicago was unexpected. The trip was, in fact, planned for well in advance, and Van Adder stated that he based his statement of this on what Cato Kalin and Arnell Simpson had told them on the early morning of June 13th. As Arnell Simpson, if you'll recall, believed her father was still at home. They also focused on the fact that Van Adder had admitted the fact that Simpson volunteered to return from Chicago, and the LAPD's defense of this was that Van Adder had not been present during the phone call to Simpson in Chicago, wherein he was informed of his wife's murder and had consequently offered to fly back to Los Angeles of his own volition. The defense also zeroed in on the fact that Van Adder had written in the search warrant that there was blood evidence present at the North Rockingham estate. This based on his experience as opposed to allowing the SID team to make the actual identification. And as a result of these challenges, the judge overseeing this particular part of the case stated, quote, "I cannot make a finding that this was merely negligent. I have to make a finding that this was reckless." And after this, according to Tom Lang, he goes up to Van Adder and informs him, quote, "Tom, you've been right about Marcia. She has no loyalty to us." This is because of the fact that Marcia Clark did not try to refute any of the things that the defense was laying on them. Despite all of this, however, Judge Lance Ito does allow the evidence to be presented at trial, which is a small victory for the prosecution. On September 25th, Philip Van Adder learns that the defense is planning on disputing the blood evidence due to mishandling. And now he learns this from a source of his close to the defense team, who has never been revealed. Obviously, the officers take this very seriously because the blood evidence is a big part of the case that they have against Simpson, and if the defense is able to get this evidence dismissed from trial, it will be a major blow to their case. They also learn from an individual within the LAPD who has friends at Time Magazine that the defense team has already contacted them and informed them that it is their contention that officers from the LAPD in fact planted evidence at both crime scenes in order to frame O.J. Simpson. We discussed this in the last episode. The defense is going to paint the picture of a police department rife with racism who have unjustly targeted O.J. Simpson for the murder of his wife and Ron Goldman, and that the officers, in fact, due to this racism, planted the evidence that was found at both crime scenes in order to destroy O.J. Simpson's career, but also to destroy his life. They're going to be helped in this by Mark Furman's own words, which we're going to get into once we actually get into the trial. And I'm going to forewarn people, we're not going massively in-depth into the O.J. Simpson trial. We are going to cover it, but I'm not going to spend, you know, 12 episodes on the trial, instead focusing on key points that need to be known. So the LAPD, as well as the prosecution's office, are now really preparing themselves for a major battle. As discussed in earlier episodes, the LAPD had assumed that Simpson would attempt to cop a plea bargain in the murders, and were quite stunned when he came out swinging and refused not only to speak with officers again, but to cop any sort of a plea with them. On Monday, September 26th, the prosecution learns that the defense team now wants hair samples from all of the individuals involved at both the North Rockingham as well as the South Bundy crime scenes. Particularly, the defense wants Mark Furman's hair samples. But not only this, the defense also wants every piece of clothing all of those officers were wearing at the time of their investigation of these crime scenes. Obviously, this is the defense gearing up to try and prove that the LAPD did, in fact, plant evidence at the crime scenes in an effort to frame O.J. Simpson for both of the murders. Now, the officers want the district attorney's office to fight these requests. However, this does not come to pass. And because of all of this, the officers begin to note that other members of the LAPD, not, you know, hands-on involved with this case, are shying away from them, but also any involvement with the Simpson trial, with one officer going so far as to state that despite the fact that he had had a minuscule part in evidence gathering, he will not be testifying for fear of the consequences that may emerge should he take the stand. Basically, what that means is that officers who are not involved with this case, and even those who are only tangentially involved, are terrified of getting the stink of what is going to come on them, and are fearing for the, both their reputations as well as their jobs because of it. And this is in large part because the district attorney's office, for whatever reason in this case, is feckless, spineless, and ineffectual in handling even the most nuanced of details concerning it and protecting the officers who the city of Los Angeles had tasked with going and investigating this crime. And obviously this comes back to the fact that Marcia Clark, Christopher Darden, and other individuals in the DA's office are basically starstruck by what is happening around them, as well as the media attention that they are receiving, and because of this, are unable to act. And it really is only going to get worse from this point onwards. On October 17th of 1994, Faye Resnick, the close personal friend of Nicole Brown Simpson, publishes a book entitled Nicole Brown Simpson, Private Diary of a Life Interrupted. The book is basically nothing more than Resnick capitalizing on her friend's demise, telling stories of their drug usage, their sexual exploits, along with recounting O.J. Simpson's spousal abuse and the fear that Nicole had felt both before and after the divorce from O.J. She also goes into detail about the threats that Simpson allegedly made against Nicole during the course of their relationship. The book is really a tabloid-type expose, eventually landing at the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list and leading to Resnick becoming a popular fixture on the talk show circuit. The release of this book does have some serious consequences. Judge Lance Ito orders that jury selection be temporarily suspended because of the publicity generated by the release of this book. The defense team requests that the trial, in fact, be postponed for at least a year, with Simpson being released on bail until the publicity from the book dies down. Now, Resnick is going to play a part in this case, although not for the prosecution, due in part to her history of heavy drug usage. The defense is going to use Resnick to paint a picture that Resnick had been targeted for murder by drug dealers, and that it was these drug dealers who had committed the murders, mistaking Nicole Brown Simpson for Faye Resnick on the night of June 12th. Despite the fact that there is no clear-cut evidence to show that this was actually a case, this particular conspiracy theory has continued to live on, just as the idea that Jason Simpson was responsible for the murders has continued to live on. It's similar in mindset to the West Memphis 3 case, in that despite all of the evidence presented in court, people are unable to take an objective look at that evidence and reach a reasonable conclusion as to what actually occurred. Despite all of this furor over Resnick's book, Ito denies the defense's motion to postpone the trial, and on Thursday, November 3rd, a four-man, eight-woman jury is duly sworn in and subsequently sequestered for the remainder of the trial. Now, this next bit happens over a period of days, and we're going to go through it fairly quickly. On Wednesday, January 4th, 1995, the defense decides not to contest the evidence collected by the detectives. On January 13th, there is a heated exchange during a pretrial hearing between Johnny Cochran and Christopher Darden over Mark Furman's alleged use of the N-word. On January 17th, the prosecution enters more evidence during a pretrial hearing concerning Simpson's spousal abuse. This time, however, it comes from his first marriage to Marguerite. This is from an officer by the name of Terry Schauer, who had responded to a call in the mid-1970s of a screaming woman on Mulholland Drive. When the officers arrived, they found evidence of physical abuse, although Marguerite refused to press any charges. They also enter evidence concerning another call, this one from 1969, wherein officers encountered a woman running through the streets in a nightgown holding her face, and when questioned, the woman repeatedly said, quote unquote, "I don't want to ruin his career, I don't want to ruin his career." On January 18th, Judge Ito decides that the prosecution may in fact introduce evidence of Simpson's domestic violence. 2 days later, he rules that the defense may introduce evidence of Furman's racist views. Right after this, the detectives learn from his supervisor that Mark Furman had been working with a script writer on a script concerning basic, you know, police life, and that this had been taking place prior to the pretrial hearing, and that upon learning of this, his supervisor had informed Furman that he needed to stop this relationship, as Furman was looking for a consultation fee should the screenwriter actually be able to sell the script that she was working on. While the detectives are standing beside Furman, the media attention that the detective is receiving is exceedingly negative. It started with the accusations leveled against him of racist views and had escalated by this point to an alleged affair that they stated he had had with Nicole. This was based on the fact that Furman had first met Nicole Brown Simpson at some point in 1985 when Nicole, who was pregnant with her first child, had placed a domestic violence call to the LAPD. This was the infamous incident in which Simpson had shattered the windshield on Nicole's car with a baseball bat. And the media really ran with this story, claiming that Nicole, fearful for her life, had turned to Mark Furman for protection as well as for a romantic relationship, with some stories stating that this alleged affair had actually begun around the time of the domestic violence call in 1985. Because of all the negative publicity that he is receiving, Mark Furman is assigned round-the-clock protection by the Metro Division. And it becomes so bad that in 1995, the LAPD Internal Affairs Division is actually going to conduct an investigation of Furman and this alleged affair. This after one officer comes forward claiming that Furman had informed him that he was having an affair with Simpson and commenting on her quote-unquote nice boob job. Furman ends up being cleared of these allegations by the Internal Affairs Office, but the stink is already on him, and despite anything that the LAPD may say, this is the kind of thing that is going to hang around his neck like an albatross for the remainder of his life. And speaking of remainders of life, during the recording of this episode, the individual at the center of this series, O.J. Simpson, passed away on April 10th, 2024, at the age of 76 years old, after a battle with stomach cancer. Now, some things have come out from friends and family members of Simpson since his death, and we're going to get into them after we get through the trial, which is, in fact, where we are now in our timeline. On Tuesday, January 24th, 1995, O.J. Simpson's trial for double homicide began. Obviously, the first day of the trial is a media circus, so much so that the detectives who had actually worked the case were unable to attend the opening day inside of the courtroom as there were just too many people and members of the media present. In their opening statements, prosecutors Clark and Darden outlined their case, talking about their
theory that Simpson was jealous of his ex-wife, and that this jealousy had led Simpson to murder Nicole. They went over the fact that Simpson is known to have physically and mentally abused his wife, as well as stalked and spied upon her. They pointed out that the attempted reconciliation between Simpson and Brown had failed, and that to outward appearances, it seemed as though Simpson was resigned to this fact. However, in reality, he was not, as he continued harassing Nicole, keeping an eye on her as she engaged in various relationships with different men, something Simpson himself did admit took place. Prosecution stated that the final insult for Simpson took place on the night of June 12th, when the Brown family basically ignored him and did not invite him to go out to dinner after the recital, which led Simpson to decide that he was going to commit murder. They characterized Ron Goldman as being a good Samaritan who was trying to help his friend out and happened upon the crime while it was in the act of being committed, and as a result of this, paid the ultimate price. The prosecution also pointed out that while they were unable to locate a murder weapon, circumstantial evidence, namely the fact that a store had come forward stating that Simpson had purchased a knife from them, indicated that this, in fact, may have been the knife used in the murders. They also stated that forensic evidence would show that Simpson had ambushed both of his victims from behind, mitigating any form of blood splatter that may have gotten on him. My issue with that particular assertion, however, is the amount of blood that was present at the crime scene. As I already stated, Nicole's head was nearly severed, and if you have seen the photographs of the crime scene as well as the bodies, even if you take into account the idea presented later on that Nicole Brown had been on the ground when her throat was cut, there was still the possibility of a good amount of blood getting on Simpson. Then you factor in Ron Goldman, who had defensive wounds, which to me at least, it doesn't appear as though his assault was strictly one where Simpson got him from behind, but was in fact facing the man for at least a period of time. I would imagine that there would have been more blood on Simpson than just the amounts that were found outside and inside of the Bronco. The prosecution then went on to summarize the fact that Simpson was not able to fully account for the period of time after he left the recital, stating that they had witnesses who would be able to back this claim up, including the limousine driver who stated to the police that he had attempted to call Simpson at roughly 10:55. Because of this, the prosecution goes out and states that it's their belief that the murders took place somewhere around 10:15 p.m., as this was when neighbors first heard Nicole Brown's dog barking, thus allowing Simpson plenty of time to commit the murders, flee the crime scene, drive the 5 minutes back to his home on North Rockingham, scale the wall, go inside of the house, and begin to clean up. After this first day of opening statements from the prosecution, Marcia Clark has Langan Van Adder return to her office with her, where she goes over the evidence and details of the crime, as well as the witnesses that they have. Now, the next day, January 25th, Johnny Cochran begins his opening statement.
According to Cochran, Simpson had accepted the fact that his marriage with Nicole Brown Simpson was over, and that the time the murders took place, Paula Barberi was the main interest in Simpson's life. Cochran further on goes on to characterize Simpson as being upbeat and friendly at his daughter's recital on the night of June 12th. And then in an effort to get ahead of some of the evidence that the prosecution is going to present, claims that while on his trip to Chicago later that evening, Simpson had engaged in handshakes and autograph signings with individuals on the plane. The defense also states that, according to their own investigation, the murders took place after 10:15 p.m., which would give Simpson no time to have committed the murders. Instead, during the period of time in question, Cochran states that Simpson spent his time chipping golf balls in the front yard, napping, showering, dressing, before packing to head for Chicago. Cochran then discusses the injuries to Simpson's left hand, specifically the cut on his middle finger, claiming that this occurred after Simpson shattered a glass in his Chicago hotel room upon learning of Nicole's death. Cochran then starts listing off various witnesses he has, which the prosecution is completely unprepared for, claiming that one witness saw four Hispanics and one Caucasian man wearing knit caps running from the crime scene, all of whom were carrying something, after which point they entered an unmarked vehicle and sped off. Cochran points out that the prosecution's assertion that the domestic abuse that Simpson had perpetrated against his ex-wife were simply a foreshadowing of his murder of her were in fact nothing more than smoke and mirrors on the prosecution's side, pointing out that they are at a murder trial. Ending his opening statement, Cochran has Simpson stand up and hobble over to the jury box, where Simpson is instructed to show the jury his knee, which is heavily scarred from multiple surgeries, to indicate to the jury that Simpson could not possibly have physically committed these crimes. After all of this is done, the jury is recessed for the day, at which point the defense team admits to the prosecution in open court that they had not, in fact, revealed to the prosecution the names of multiple witnesses. This is a violation of California's dual discovery law, which basically means that both sides have to share information with one another. Darden is given a list of these particular witnesses, whom he states in court are, quote, heroin addicts, thieves, felons, and a court-certified pathological liar. This withholding of witness names is another in the long list of contentious actions by the defense team towards the prosecution. Detective Lang later states that this was an unscrupulous maneuver, although in my personal opinion, the defense should not be required to provide the prosecution a list of names of those individuals that they are planning on calling to the witness stand. The next day, Thursday, January 26th, Judge Ito agrees to hear complaints from both the defense and the prosecution, during which Cochran really starts to paint the picture that Colombian drug dealers were responsible for the murders, not O.J. Simpson, stating that these drug dealers had in fact been targeting Faye Resnick. This theory, however, is going to be barred from open court, meaning when the jury is present, as the defense has absolutely no evidence to back this claim up. Judge Ito ends up allowing the prosecution the opportunity to amend their opening statement due to the defense's withholding of witness names, informing the jury that the defense team has committed misconduct in doing so. Moving on, the prosecution start to call witnesses, and they're focusing on Simpson's physical and mental abuse of Nicole Brown. This involves everything from family members to law enforcement personnel who were involved during the various periods when Nicole was able to get the cops to come to the house. After this, they began to present witnesses who would come on the stand to attest to the timeline of events that the prosecution had laid out in as it concerns June 12, 1994. After all of this is established, the prosecution has Officer Robert Riske, who was the first officer on the scene, the individual who had discovered the bodies after being called out for a potential burglary, as well as the actions that he took afterwards, namely contacting headquarters and attempting to secure the crime scene so that no one could either come in or leave. On Sunday, February 12th, the entire court, including the jury, take a field trip to both the South Bundy and North Rockingham crime scenes. This really creates more of the media circus atmosphere, as large portions of the freeway between the crime scenes and the courthouse are closed off so that this contingent, along with a large cadre of SWAT team members, can make their way over to the crime scene. The media is hot on their trail with vehicles and helicopters scrutinizing every single movement. It was later noted by both members of the prosecution and the defense that at this point, everything had begun to take on a carnival-like atmosphere, and at least from the prosecution side, they noted that this day in particular really drove that idea home for them, as both well-wishers and individuals who believed Simpson was guilty lined the streets to watch the parade of vehicles go by. The first stop is Ron Goldman's apartment on Gorham Avenue, followed by the Mezzaluna restaurant, after which they travel to the crime scenes. And it was noted that at the South Bundy crime scene, where the bodies were discovered, the thick foliage that had overhung the walkway had been cleared away, something that was pointed out to both the judge and the jury, as from the street, the bodies of the victims were not visible. It's going to later be claimed, although this will never be able to be verified, from a neighbor that the defense team had shown up at some point after the murders had taken place with a gardener who had cleaned up the foliage in order to make it appear that what the prosecution was alleging was in fact not probable. Namely, that individuals had walked by the house after the murders had taken place and not seen anything. At the North Rockingham estate, it's noted that various pictures inside of Simpson's home have been replaced with images of his mother and Dr. Martin Luther King. They also note that there is a Holy Bible stationed strategically on the nightstand beside Simpson's bed. there would later be a little bit of a furor over the fact that during the tour of the North Rockingham estate, Robert Shapiro stated to Officer Lang in a stage whisper, which means loud enough for everybody to hear it, that Simpson had said in the drive over, quote, "Hey, isn't this the route I took?" We are at the end of the first week of the trial, and I am going to cut it off at this point. Next week, we're going to get into, hopefully, the rest of the trial. Again, I hope you are enjoying the deep dive into the murderers of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. If you are, please tell somebody about it. Like the show on your favorite podcast app. Leave a 5-star review. Consider becoming a Patreon member. It really does help out the show. Until next time, the Deathcast is a co-production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid.